This is the Oanda Podcast, brought to you by Jazz FM's Business Breakfast.
Welcome back to the Oanda Market Insights Podcast, brought to you with the Jazz FM Business Breakfast, and now available on iTunes and Android. I'm Johnny Hart. Each week, we review the stories that made the business and market headlines, as well as look forward to the week to come. And it's been another dramatic week.
Chairman Kim and I just signed a joint statement in which he reaffirmed his unwavering commitment to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. We also agreed to vigorous negotiations to implement the agreement as soon as possible.
Progress towards a sustained adjustment in inflation has been substantial. With longer-term inflation expectations well anchored, we will continue to make net purchases at the current monthly pace until the end of September 2018.
Gradually returning interest rates to a more normal level as the economy strengthens is the best way the Fed can help sustain an environment in which American households and businesses can thrive. We've taken another step in that process by raising our target range for the federal funds rate by a quarter of a percentage.
Yes, plenty to talk about. That, of course, was US Fed Chief Jerome Powell, preceded by ECB President Mario Draghi, and, of course, US President Donald J. Trump talking from Singapore following that extraordinary meeting with Kim Jong-un, and plenty to discuss. Let's first speak to Oanda senior market analyst Craig Earlham here in London and say hello.
Good afternoon.
And on the line from Singapore, Oanda head of trading for Asia, Stephen Innes. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm very good, Johnny. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Of course, the eyes of the world were on Singapore, so it must have been quite a surreal atmosphere in the city-state this week, Steve.
It was quite bizarre, you know, not only with the heightened security presence, but Singapore was just showcased by the hordes of media that were in town. And I think one of the more interesting aspects was the fact that the night before the summit that Premier Kim Jong-un was walking around Marina Bay Sands, the iconic hotel here, waving at all the Singaporean public. It was actually pre-announced, so we had actually the chance to run over there. And it was one of those things where, you know, you saw this gentleman, he was walking around smiling, waving, and being very congenial. So, you know, it really took me by surprise because I had just the complete opposite opinion or impressions of the North Korean leader. And it sort of set my concerns quite at ease, just the way he was carrying himself. And it really did foreshadow of, you know, the positive things to come.
When all is said and done, though, Steve, was there any genuine substance? Perhaps that doesn't really matter. Perhaps it was just the mere fact that the two leaders actually met.
Yeah, I think that's the key there. I think there have been a lot of ink spilt regarding the summit and really whatever end of the political spectrum you sit. It was a fantastic start, and now the president can now correctly hand the baton over to Mike Pompeo and the team, more likely to do the heavy lifting. So in other words, the summit was little more than a prologue, and what's likely going to be a long drawn out event. So I think we had this attitude going in that our expectations were high that we were going to see something signed, but our expectations for any definitive announcement or any sudden economic impact was going to be quite unlikely because, you know, after all, you know, we're talking about nuclear proliferation and, you know, taming down this offensive country that we have in Asia. So we weren't expecting things to get settled overnight. And the market really didn't react all that wildly. There was a bit of positivity built in on the way up, but realistically, it faded very quickly.
It was difficult, Craig, wasn't it, for markets to digest, to realize the implications of this? I mean, perhaps this has strengthened Trump's hand in many other ways when you take into account the Iran situation. Maybe this has made it easier for him because people actually believe in what he says. They're actually going to get a deal done with the North Koreans. And they're thinking, well, maybe he could do the same thing with Iran. On the other hand, China maybe stand to gain the most from this deal if it goes ahead geopolitically and indeed economically.
You have to wonder what President Trump means by total denuclearization and what Mr. Kim Jong-un means by it, because you wonder, have they spent decades building up this arsenal only to agree to complete denuclearization? Was a seat at the table all he wanted all along? Does he maintain it afterwards? I think it's extremely difficult to say. Donald Trump has certainly scored a victory here, and you wonder how that is going to move forward, because, like you say, if this has worked with North Korea, can he now say, well, we have to continue the pressure on Iran because my way has worked in the past and my way will work again? The other thing as well is you see something today which we're going to address later in the show. He slaps $50 billion of tariffs on China. So would he have done this without the North Korean thing? The proximity to this event seems quite interesting. It's like, I've got this victory, the economy's doing well, so now I can do something which is economically not necessarily very sensible, because look at me, I've achieved this, I can do what I want.
Steve, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I think Craig touched on a number of valid points. Just a couple of things to add here from a regional perspective. Going in, we had this idea that it wasn't just the U.S. alone here. We were looking at China, we were looking at Japan, and of course South Korea, which were all extending a very flexible olive branch to North Korea. And I think at the end of the day here, I think North Korea and, you know, Kim Jong-un himself said this path to prosperity is just too hard to ignore. I mean, let's be realistic. You know, by dropping down, by dismantling some of his nuclear ambitions, or even taking all the nuclear ambitions off the table, I think this is obviously a step towards reducing sanctions. I also think this is a step towards creating bilateral trade amongst the Asian Pacific countries, along with opening Korea to the world. I think this is a very important step. Again, we're quite tempered on our expectations in regards that we don't expect this to unfold overnight. This is going to draw out for months, if not years ahead. But I think it's as I mentioned earlier, it's a good first step.
There was so much going on this week, Craig, and we normally talk about your market moment of the week. Was this your moment of the week?
I'd say this was my moment of the week. I think market-wise, as Steve earlier alluded to, the market impact was quite marginal, if not completely muted. I think markets tend to, what we see is they'll typically respond far more to negative news than they will a positive step in the right direction. So with the market response was muted. So I'd say this was by far and away my moment of the week, if not the moment of the year so far. The market moment of the week, though, is more central bank based, which is hardly surprising when you consider how many events there has been this week. And it's the ECB, you only have to look at the movements that we saw in the euro yesterday to really understand why the whole pop and drop aspect of it. It was the most Mario Draghi event I think you could hope to see. He announces something which is quite hawkish from my perspective, because people knew that they were going to allude to discussions this week, but they didn't necessarily anticipate that the announcement of what was going to happen with QE was going to come. It was a soft exit from QE with an extra 3 months at half the rate. But the fact that I even touched on interest rates about the middle of next year, that came as quite a surprise to me. So you've got this hawkish announcement to an extent, but then it was wrapped up in so much dovish language that the euro pops higher and then plummets. I mean, it's the Draghi effect in full flow.
Yeah, the euro fell after the bank pledged to keep the interest rates unchanged. We're talking about record lows at least through to the summer of 2019. That is a longer time frame that investors had priced in.
Yeah, it was sort of an interesting dilemma we were going through, because we just came out of a very, very hawkish Federal Reserve FOMC meeting, and the dollar didn't react the way we had expected. I mean, the gains were very, very minimal, and as a matter of fact, they started backing up. But getting into the ECB, I think this actually magnified the issue. We were actually positioning, some of the traders were positioning, thinking that perhaps the ECB would be a roadblock, but they actually proved to be a significant U.S. dollar catalyst. And really, looking at the downside move we've had on the euro, it's not that hard to justify. The ECB wasn't just dovish. They were overtly dovish by pushing back not only rate hike expectations, but also their growth outlook. So, you know, in my view, Draghi laid it on thick, but he also applied it in several layers. So, yeah, this is why we're seeing this aggressive reaction to the downside in the euro. Caught the market completely flat-footed.
I think it was really interesting as well. Like you say, he really did lay it on thick. And the interesting thing is that the markets, we don't seem to learn from what's happened in the past to an extent, because we have to remember every time the ECB has laid out plans which remove some accommodation, they've always accompanied it with a nice thick layer of dovish language so as to manage the currency. So, and the amount of times we've seen the euro fall after a hawkish announcement has been quite remarkable. You'll remember when this tapering which started, Mario Draghi was so insistent that it wasn't tapering. It was quite clearly tapering, but he was so worried about the taper tantrum that the US Federal Reserve experienced that he was determined that this thing, which resembled closely tapering, wasn't tapering. And we shouldn't be surprised anymore what the ECB is going to do. And like I say, then you get that reaction in the markets, and it's just repeated as past.
We're going to have to move on because there is so much to talk about this week. Let's switch to the US Fed's decision to raise rates by a quarter point. That, of course, was expected. And earlier in the montage, we heard Jerome Powell announce the hike. He was pretty buoyant, wasn't he, Steve, about the US economy? What stood out for you in that statement?
Yeah, I think really there's a couple of things that I focused on here. One, obviously, positivity surrounding growth going forward. But I think the growth has actually been quite justified. So it's just not idle banter here. If you look back at the set of data that we've gone through out of the U.S. economy, particularly leading back to last month's retail sales number, which surprised on the upside, followed up by this month's retail sales number, sort of indicates the Federal Reserve Board's hawkish view in the sense that we are starting to see some trickle-down effect from the Trump tax cuts. So this is a positive thing here. I think, however, what was quite interesting, the take I had was that despite the fact we're not getting any follow-through inflation right now, the Feds are still prepared to move forward. And this suggests to me that the economy, the surging economy, is as much of a factor as what inflation is right now. And this is quite divergent from the Federal Reserve Board under Dr. Yellen, where she was absolutely steadfast, more concerned about inflation. So I think while inflation signals are going to count, and I also believe that the Feds are going to be incredibly data dependent around inflation, I think any uptick in inflation is going to be viewed quite positively, and this could perhaps cement the Fed's dot plot scenario that they've moved higher in both 2018 and through 2019.
Of course, we've ended the week with the news that China has had $50 billion worth of tariffs imposed on it by the United States, and the Chinese say they will respond quickly. So we're expecting some countermeasures. This time last week, Craig, we were ruminating as to what was going to happen at the G7. Of course, that was quite dramatic as well. We thought that the imposition of tariffs threw the whole meeting of the G7 into disarray, with Donald Trump retracting his endorsement of the joint statement, lashing out at the host, Canada. I mean, all of this seems like a long time ago, to be honest. It's just a week ago, but so much has gone beyond that. These new tariffs imposed on China, they are going to worry markets, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. You get the feeling that, to use a trade term, surpluses and deficits, you get the feeling that Trump is using all his political surplus, which has been gathered from the passing of tax reforms in the US, from the North Korean situation, and the fact that the economy is booming right now, and he's going to use some of that capital and deploy it, and effectively starting a trade scuffle, should we call it right now? You can't call it a trade war at this stage, with all of its allies and others in an attempt to try and secure another victory. So you can see where he's weighing this up and why and how he's doing it. But the problem is he's picking on a lot of people. I feel like this is a battle he's going to really struggle to lose. You're picking on the European Union, an enormous trading bloc, China, the world's second largest economy and still growing at quite a rapid pace. You wonder how this one can actually work out well for him, because while no one else wants to be involved in a full-blown trade war, the rhetoric we're getting from China, for example, in response to this is, we are going to come back at you. And there's midterm elections coming up later this year. They, like the European Union, really appear to be honing in on the swing states in the US and the areas which they can punish Donald Trump politically, as opposed to necessarily just focusing purely on the economy. So I think the next 6 months is going to be so interesting on the trade front.
We talked last week about this all being part of the negotiation process, though, didn't we? And are you hopeful, Steve, that this is just that, part of a long-term negotiation process by the Americans, and then they'll come to some sort of compromise in the end?
I think undoubtedly cooler heads are going to prevail. Obviously, Donald Trump is not a politician. We have to keep that, up front and center. He's more of a businessman. So I think when he's going into these negotiations, he's coming from with a businessman's perspective that he's going to take the opposite end of the spectrum. And then, as we've seen ever so often, he tends to walk back the more bellicious comments and that he's made around trade. He does appear, however, or the administration does appear to, however, to be setting specific direct tariffs towards specific areas they feel that they're getting compromised on the trade issue. Now, whether this is a smart move or not, only time will tell. What I have been noticing and what I have been following out of China is China continues to offer that olive branch again. In other words, they are trying to be as accommodative as they can possibly be by opening up, for instance, like by opening up mainland China's capital markets a little bit more freer, making some concessions on automobile imports, making some concessions on gas imports. In other words, oil imports. In other words, bringing more oil in from the shale oil producers. So all this stuff is actually some significant points. However, the president continues to seem to have this uncontrollable need to defend his status more so than whatever strategy he's coming up with on trade. And this is what worries me. Is this just a big ego getting in front of this, or is there really anything behind it? And this is where it becomes a little bit dangerous. And for traders and for market analysts, very difficult to trade, because we really don't understand where he's going or what direction he's going to take next.
Yeah, and it's also his unpredictability, I guess, that worries people, and the fact that he will, or you at least get the impression that he will go much further than other world leaders would like to take this in order to try and get what he wants from these negotiations. So he will happily sacrifice more than other previous presidents may have been may have done. And again, the problem necessarily that we have here, but if he gets his own way in the end and he gets a trade deal or he gets agreements with these countries that reduces the US deficit, then this sends the message to the rest of the world that the only way to get things done is to be hostile rather than friendly with each other. And is that in the longer term the message we want to send?
And is he actually putting the US economy at the forefront rather than his own self-preservation?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where you're weighing up near-term victories versus potential long-term problems. And Trump, in many cases, what we're looking at right now is choosing near-term victories. Tax reform is a very clear example of that. He's not going to be in office by the time that the debt comes due on tax reform, if, as many economists, etc., have warned, that you will not see the offset loss from tax against growth alone. So, I mean, it's very difficult and it's going to be a long time. But if it secures him a second term in office, then he will consider that job done.
You know, it seems almost like a nagging backache we have to deal with every morning we wake up. And this is the way I look at trade. It seems to get better as the day wears on, only to wake up the next day and having another headline to deal with. I just hope we get this settled, because I think this is a huge negative for the global growth narrative. I don't see any positive coming out of this. So I really hope cooler heads prevail and we can get a meeting of the minds and get on with the real business at hand. And that is getting the world in a happier spot and getting trade working again.
This side of the pond and on this side of the channel, it hasn't exactly been a quiet week either. We've had numerous parliamentary votes on Brexit, inflation figures, more problems on the UK high street. It's hard to know where to look. And I suppose the question is, Craig, which of those areas of importance were markets most fixated on this week?
Well, again, it's so interesting, because I think clearly the most important thing this week was the votes in the House of Commons. It was this idea of how tied are Theresa May's hands going to be, what leverage does she still have for these negotiations, and how much power have we effectively given to the EU? And that will depend on how the talks continue to go, because she still has to appease a number of different people within her own party. But how much power have we now given to the EU in these negotiations in order to preserve effectively the democratic vote in the Houses of Parliament? Because it's quite clear that while we all would like our own MPs to have a vote on the final deal and be able to say this deal isn't good enough, but we certainly don't want a no-deal Brexit, if the EU knows this, this is the problem that David Cameron had prior to Brexit in the first place. He was going to the EU and he was saying to them, look, if you don't negotiate with us on these terms, then this could end up going to a referendum and we could actually end up voting to leave. And the EU weighed that up and said, well, we understand the situation here, but we need to look after ourselves. We're not really going to give you anything to go back with, and I will take our chances with that referendum, which we think we'll get away with. Now, they didn't get away with it last time, but it says a lot about the mindset of these negotiations. If the EU know that the alternative to what the deal they give us is a no deal, then maybe they take this a lot more seriously. So it's a very difficult situation for Theresa May, and it's a very difficult situation for all concerned.
What's the view from Singapore on our little local trouble here in the UK as regards Brexit? How big a part does it play in your daily life, your news feeds and the markets that you look at, Steve?
Oh, it's actually very significant. I mean, just with regards to the expat community alone, over in Singapore, there's a lot of UK traders located here in the banks, and we get the social banter along with the actual market banter. So it's quite involved here. I think what we seem to be moving from is this. What appears to be a seismic event day every week. So whether it's we're dealing with government unity against all odds, whether we're making some big concessions to the softer Brexiteers, or whether it's then the EU licking their lips because they think they're getting a sweeter deal, these narratives, we just keep on changing by the week. And I think this is what makes it so difficult to really position for on sterling, is that these uncertainties are certainly weighing on central bank policy, and we almost running central bank policy risk on how Brexit's going. So yeah, it's actually becoming a real focus, and something that's very difficult to predict and digest on a really quantified basis.
Before we leave this week, guys, it'd be good to get your view of the week ahead. What are you most looking forward to, Steve?
Well, we're really focusing because in the region here, we think the local currencies are going to be quite impacted by not only the stronger U.S. dollar, which really acts like a wrecking ball through emerging market currencies, but also how this trade tensions are going to roll out, given the fact that most of the Asian economies are export oriented, so it's quite sensitive, and of course because we're so tied up with oil prices, and oil prices far-reaching consequence they have across a multitude of asset classes. We're really focusing on the OPEC meeting, which is coming up in Vienna on June 22nd. Higher oil prices have been sparking inflation throughout the globe, but there have also been hurting a lot of the local emerging market currencies and economies that are oil dependent. So that's going to be our major focus coming up next week.
What about you, Craig?
Yeah, I mean, the OPEC meeting, I think, is going to be really interesting, because this is almost going to turn into a potential, and at least on the face of it, would look like another victory for Donald Trump, because this OPEC meeting, and towards the end of the year, we were naturally going to see oil production starting to pick back up again, because the reserves are now falling in line with the five-year average, which was always their policy goal with regards to the production cuts. The fact that the sanctions on Iran means that OPEC production is going to be end up being slightly lower means that the Saudis were always open to filling that void, and I think Russia will be more than happy to start ramping up production at these levels price-wise. But because Trump's now been tweeting for the last few weeks and even for the last couple of months saying that OPEC are at it again and the artificially higher prices, if OPEC now come out next Friday and say, yeah, we've decided to ramp up production again and go back towards the levels, then this is going to be look like another Trump victory, even though it was always going to happen. We also do have one more central bank meeting next week, which is amazing when you think of, you thought we'd run out after this week. The Bank of England will meet on Thursday, so that will be of particular interest given the central bank's backtracking at the last meeting? Are they going to try and ramp up expectations for a rate hike this year, even if it's still a little too soon at this moment in time? And we're also going to hear from a number of different central bank heads on Wednesday, which I think will be very interesting. Jerome Powell, Kuroda from the Bank of Japan, Mario Draghi, and Governor Lowe as well from the Reserve Bank of Australia. So we're not going to be short of central bank appearances next week either.
Thank you once again, Craig Earlham.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us today, Steve.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed my time.
Have a very good week. And of course, we will be back same time next week with the Oanda Market Insights podcast.
Was the Oanda podcast from the team behind Jazz FM's Business Breakfast, a daily early morning 30-minute briefing for the day ahead. On air from 6 a.m. Listen to Jazz FM on DAB, online, or just ask Alexa.